without a beard, go pike. I'm trying to think of
Heaven's Gate.
Heaven's Gate, you're right. Oh, the first part of it. Yeah. Pat Garrett, you're right.
And speaking of Cisco Pike, I guess at least I have a tendency to see you as kind of a counterculture character in many of your films. And certainly there's a radical departure in Rollover. Or do you see it?
Uh-huh. Well, yeah, as far as the roles go, and I'm. My friend Vernon White told me that it was the first time he'd ever seen me in shoes that tied. Yeah, it was good.
And Jane, and
my daughter laughed for 15 minutes when I told her I was playing a banker. She said, and I is the one who's in college. So I don't know of anybody on the planet who cares or understands less about money than you.
Is that true? You don't have a checkbook?
True. How did you know that?
I heard.
I thought only my bank knew that.
How do you play a banker? How do you play a banker if you have no background in banking or finance?
Well, the argument I used with Alan, who also felt I was, I think his term was I was too rural and laid back. He felt the role was that I was a character. To me, was not someone that I couldn't identify with going back about 20 years in my experience, back to when I was a Rhodes Scholar and 5'8 and a football player and a lot of different things that this sort of Kennedy-esque type of character, hotshot, that the character represented to me was. He'd be like the fair-haired boy in the military division, you know, who would be sent out to troubleshoot the bad company. You know, he'd be the newcomer commander. I could identify with that.
And speaking of which, when you traded the West Point environment of teaching for country music composing, I mean, were there some second thoughts in your mind about that? Or?
Well, it was a little terrifying, because it was going from a secure place, a relatively secure, to a very chancy future. I mean, if I had known how chancy, I probably would have stepped forth with a lot more trepidation, you know, but it was as exhilarating as a free fall out of an airplane, too. It was like scary, but it was free. It was certainly the structure of military life was at odds with my personality, and the life in Nashville was represented somewhere that was totally 180 degrees different, where I didn't have to get up in the morning if I didn't want to, and I didn't have to wear anything I didn't want to. I didn't have to shave. I didn't have to cut my hair. That didn't mean that I didn't still have the pieces in my personality that made up the person who had been the other guy too, which is what I'm able. I wanted to use for the character in this.
I was going to say, were there those who said that your voice would never lend itself to vocal?
There are those who still say that.
And I was going to make a parallel then between that and the kind of personality that you convey and the characters now that you're dealing with on the screen in Rollover. There would seem to be a disparity, but maybe not.
Well, there's a whole different rhythm of talking. Of speech, which became immediately apparent to me the first trading room I went into, from the way we talk on the bus with my band. But again, it wasn't something that I couldn't identify with because at a period in my life, there was a time in my life when I talked a lot differently and was around people who talked a lot differently than the people I'm around now, and it was just a matter of going back about 20 years
How much time did you spend around, like the trading rooms and so forth? I mean, did you really?
Not a whole lot. Yeah. A few days or a week.
But somebody somewhere online said something about there is kind of a new breed of young bankers, I guess, that are like this character.
Well, they're all young. All the people were young that I saw, because there just weren't any old people in there. Because of the I think it's something like an airline traffic coordinator. You know, there's the burnout because of the intensity of the. They don't even get up for lunch. They have their meals wheeled around to them, and the economy of the language. You know, they just don't have time for verbal footwork. You know, it's
that here in New York, or like on the West Coast, or
well, this is New York where I saw it, but I imagine it's the same.
Probably exists. Dallas supposed to be a big banking center, except I don't know. I've never been in that.
But I would imagine that they're all fairly, you know, pretty much the same, mm-hmm. because of the demands of the job. I can see how nothing bores me more than figures. And I mean, I have real trouble staying awake when my accountant talks to me. But I can translate it to an excitement of this games player or troubleshooter that the guy was.
Well, I think that's maybe what I was getting down to, the specific character you play. There are these kind of banking guys out there, these troubleshooter kind of guys.
Yeah. And that they're probably take as much pride as Henry Kissinger took in his stuff.
Mm-hmm.
In being able to be on top of a lot of situations. And as far as I was concerned, it was an interesting challenge just in the just to play that different a type of a character. Because in my world, in the music, I mean, all I have to focus on is my music, is the microphone in front of me, the band behind me. These people can carry on a conversation and have a 360-degree peripheral hearing going on, where they're talking to you and aware of this conversation that's going on back here about Saudi Arabia, and turn over and say something about something that happened in Bahrain, and then come back to me in football, and that's interesting.
I mentioned that counterculture image that you had. There is a scene in Rollover when you're talking with Hume Cronin and you're angry at him because he didn't go through channels. He did not consult the Secretary of the Treasury, etc. There's a part or dimension of your character there that's by the book.
Mm-hmm.
There needs to be a system upheld here. That's one of the differences I see between a film like Rollover and, say, Cisco Pike.
Well, there are a lot of differences between Rollover and Cisco Pike. But I think that more that scene, like with Hume Cronin, was a question more of basic principles and of right and wrong, you know. But maybe the same thing you are about there being a right way and a structured way of doing things. But it was the disillusion that he felt with the Hume's character. Was this disillusion is finding out your daddy's a crook, you know, and that he doesn't live up to what you thought he did, which is a little bit of a contradiction with the character of the games. I mean, the games player himself is not above reproach. You know, I'm sure that Hub Smith knew about the games that the power people play with other people's money. But he thought there was, the way I understood him was there was an underlying ethics that he believed in.
One of the conflicts in the script between you and Lee, there's the suspicion there that you're doing her in.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, she responds in kind. At any point in your involvement with the script or the production, was that considered a possibility in the plot, that actually this would be happening? Here, it's a mistaken assumption.
No, I mean, not in reality, but it should be. I mean, for the purposes of the story, it should, the mistake had to occur. To me, one of the basic things of the sort of themes of the film was the conflict between doubt and faith. You know, like you had to have faith in the economic system, Cronin did, or it would all fall apart. You had to have faith in a human relationship, or it would not last. When they begin their relationship, or when they're talking, the first time they're talking about it, like in that airplane, and he says that mistrust or doubt is a great basis for a business relationship. There's this tension between faith and commitment, and doubt and holding back from commitment. That to me was interesting in the two characters. They have tremendous attraction to each other, but being both games players. One of the essences of the games player personality is the fact that you don't close off your options by committing yourself to one person or to one thing, and so you have this conflict in the two of them.
You said you don't like figures, but did any of these things that we're talking about, figures, facets about this film, scare you as you were being involved in the film? The idea of the world economy.
Well, I'd say I'm not interested in them, and I'm scared by them anyway, even before the film. I can get paranoid about my own money. You know? I think paranoia is kind of directly proportional to your ignorance about a subject, and I am very ignorant about my money, and don't say that in my account, will probably get on me. I think it's easy to be paranoid about the world situation today too, because certainly the reliance or the possible dependence on the vast amounts of petrodollar deposits in the American banks, coupled with the instability of the Middle East, doesn't make for a real secure financial situation. And the economic instability in the United States right now is the cover of Time magazine. You know, Stockman's in trouble because he told the truth about not that they didn't know what was going on up there.
I'm
talking to one economic advisor on the movie right now. I don't know who was the economic advisor on the movie.
Do you think Rollover will have an influence of any kind in the roles that you have in the future, the kind of persona that people will see on the screen?
I've only seen it once. I would hope that anything that I do would increase my options. That maybe people who didn't see me acting in The Star Is Born because I happened to be playing a singer would say, "Oh, this guy can act," you know, because they don't see me as a banker. You know, but there's also the possibility to say he can't do a goddamn thing but sing. You know? I would like to just think that it opened up a wider variety of things that I would get a chance to play.
In other words, maybe then you think it's important to be known as a versatile actor rather than an actor with one basic kind of power.
Well, if you're interested in acting, yeah, which I am. I think that like a lot of things playing in Cisco Pike or in Bloom in Love or Alice or Star Is Born, where people more or less thought I was just being playing myself. I was acting as much as I was acting in Rollover, but because of whatever image they brought to the party, they thought that I was just playing me then, and I was playing somebody else now. I think it'll be easier to maybe see the craft.
Can you see an improvement in your acting when you watch your films chronologically?
Well, I still think some of the best work I did was in The Star Is Born, but maybe because of the story itself, of the range of the colors that the guy was able to show. You know, there was a lot of humor and emotion, various emotions in it, and I can't bust myself in many places in there. I like my work in there better than, say, Semi-Tough, which was after that. But that, again, that was a more difficult role to play. There was a dull character, you know, that I couldn't do a whole lot with.
You get intimidated working with Jane Fonda, not so much that she's Jane Fonda, but that she made several films with Alan Cabrillo before?
No. Both of them were so supportive. And I didn't go into it intimidated because I figured they wouldn't have hired me if they didn't want to work with me, you know. And also, I don't have a low opinion of my ability as an actor. You know, I mean, I'm not insecure about it. But when I did get insecure, they were real good at spotting it and helping me out of it. Usually my insecurity expresses itself in anger, and they were able to stop it without making me more angry.
Is there an example from the film that you can recall in that regard?
Well, I can't think of one. I can think of a scene where that turned out well, where I did start to slip into that. What happened was when I got insecure, I'd start out angry about there'd be foul ups on the set, maybe, and I'd be feeling also uneasy about sitting there without a beard on. And feeling like I looked like a porpoise, and sitting in a different position than I imagined, you know, and doing the scene a little bit different, and eventually the anger gets back right onto me, and I tend to close myself in and sit there like, okay, you can shoot this son of a bitch, but I'm not doing nothing, you know, I might as well be a rock. But I don't know whether it's because she's been through a lot of therapy herself or whatever, but Jane had a way of being able to point this out to me, what I was doing, the self-destructiveness of it, and bring me out without making me so mad by telling me that I would shut up more. It was like the scene in the airplane together. I can't really think of it.
Yes, Jane was very helpful. You say you feel like you're working The Star Is Born along your best. Was Streisand helpful in the same way?
How
does that proceed?
I'll tell you, it wasn't as obvious to me.
There is a diplomat.
In retrospect, I have a lot of gratitude. At the time, we were both fighting to protect the integrity of different territories, and I can see, looking at the film now, a lot of opportunities that she gave me that weren't as obvious to me when I was drinking a quart and a half of tequila and a case of beer a day.
Would you make another film with Barbra Streisand?
In a minute.
I heard a rumor that your music was going more rock-oriented. Is that true?
I'm still more lyric-oriented than I think rock music is. Maybe you're talking about instrumentation. I don't know. I feel more comfortable with my band, and I'm more into rhythms now than I might have been before. It's not as plodding and pedestrian maybe as it used to be in the old days. I feel that the music's more integrated altogether now. I know a lot more than I did.
Do you like your work in Heaven's Gate, or do you think the press was fair with that movie?
Yes to the first question, no to the second.
Okay.
I thought the reaction to Heaven's Gate, I think there can be artistic objections to the film that are valid. I think most of the criticism that I read was directed at something else. I had the feeling that the industry drew the line at Cimino. It was like the president of UA said in an article the day that the film was screened in Cannes, he said, "We've got to get control out of the hands of these creative people," unquote, or the industry's headed for disaster. And I think a lot of hostility came to the film before it was shown. The same thing may happen to Reds. I also feel that something happened in A Star Is Born that happened, a similar thing happened in Heaven's Gate, was that they didn't allow any press on the set, and they didn't have many stories about coming out at the time. And in the absence of this, things were printed by, like in the case of Heaven's Gate, a disgruntled extra had two huge articles in the LA Times. Now here's a guy who has never worked as an extra before, and is quoted on his criticism of Michael Cimino's directorial techniques. The guy didn't know anything about what was going on. He was annoyed about he didn't get a lunch one day or something. I thought, as I did when Frank Pearson came out with an article in New West before The Stars Born came out, I thought anybody who knows anything about films is going to know that this is crap. You know, they're not going to take it seriously. But unfortunately, they didn't. Or at least they didn't take, they took it seriously enough for the LA Times to print it in the calendar section, and for a lot of people to come to the to The Stars Born with a hostile attitude. A lot of it had to do with people's hostility toward Michael's supposed arrogance, and the same with Barbra. You know? I tend to side with the arrogant creative person rather than the accountants or the lawyers, but like the lawyer in Norman Auerbach's office pointed out to me, it's not my money. I pointed out to him it wasn't his either. But I forget what the question was.
You know,
I wondered if you felt they were being fair about Heaven's Gate.
No, I felt that at least the thing was going for a piece of art. It was like he was almost busted for trying for something good. Had he tried to go for something that was Caveman or they said 1941 and Blues Brothers cost more. They didn't get near the vicious reaction that Heaven's Gate got.
Well, and Titanic cost 36.
So oh my God, yeah, I know that was one.
Was 25. Nobody, they seemed to single Cimino out.
Well, it was almost like you got busted for going for it, I felt. And it was an unfortunate tendency. I got hypersensitive to that kind of thing. But it seemed like I would read criticism of certain albums that would come out. You know, Debbie Harry's Old Man. They said he got pretentious because he tried to do something more than rock. You know, it's an odd thing to criticize someone for.
The scenario surrounding Heaven's Gate was very similar to the one surrounding Apocalypse Now, and yet Apocalypse Now turned out was vindicated. Do you think that with three decent reviews in those New York dailies, the same might have happened to Heaven's Gate? It might have.
I think so. I think you could attack Tin Drum just as heavily as you could attack Heaven's Gate. You know, but I don't think Tin Drum would have been made in the States. And and I'm not saying that there aren't artistic objections to Heaven's Gate, but not. I don't think it was a total failure as it was. I think the first review that came out was sort of opened a floodgate. You know, it was like, I was at the opening here, and I think a lot of people didn't know what to say about it. I didn't know what to say about it, to be honest. I had never seen a daily of it. But I was at the intermission, I was waiting to get in the men's room down there, and I didn't hear a person say a word. And they weren't not saying anything because I was there, because I was in the line. They didn't even know I was there. And but then when Simon came out and said, this is a total failure, it's like unredeemed by anything, it was like, oh, well, I don't need to understand it. You know, it's a piece of crap. And now that's an oversimplified reaction to the thing, but there was a lot in Heaven's Gate that was beautiful. I think that opening still knocks me out of the running through the streets there in Oxford, and some of the panoramic scenes in Montana.
Do you think it'll be rediscovered in 20 years?
Who knows? You know, Napoleon was
being recut again. Is that?
Yeah.
Well, I think Michael stopped that in a court. I hope he did. I think one of the most ridiculous things to do is to take the thing and try and, I mean, if you hired an artist to do a picture, and then hired somebody else to go in and cut the thing up.
No, I thought he was redoing it.
Oh no, I don't think so.
The version that was here, which is, we didn't see, I didn't see, I saw the second one. He was satisfied pretty much that was
the second
film.
One?
No, the first one. I mean, the premiere film.
I think Michael could have used more time.
Yeah.
He felt he was real felt real pressured at the time. He didn't get to screen it for anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are elements of both versions that he liked.
Mm-hmm.
Can you share with us an important difference in your mind between working with Cimino and working with Makula in terms of their own styles and what they bring to their work?
Well,
and how it affected you as an actor?
Well, I'll have to say that I was that reminded me of something that was that's real important. Working with both of them was great from an actor's point of view, and I was surprised to find out. I was talking with Bobby Carradine that he was surprised that I said working with Cimino was an actor's dream, because in the first place, you were working with totally a first-class operation. You had Vilmos behind the camera. You had the most authentic sets that I've ever worked with, and. A care taken with each scene that was like a little piece of art, where a man's the director is personally inspecting every extra and setting him out in position. This costs, but it's great from an actor's point of view. Also, he had unlimited takes to work. I mean, it was like going to school. That could be frustrating too, when I didn't know why in the world we were doing it 54 times. But it was, from an actor's point of view, it was good training for me. He was also very into the performance. Like for someone who is working with something with the scope of a big of a big epic like thing like that, he was able at the same time to really focus in on what the actors were doing, what I was doing, and to criticize little things in the performance that I would imagine a director who is so worried about the logistics of the, I mean, it was like D-Day, you know, when you have that many people out there, it'd be hard to focus in on the acting, and he was really into that. And that was the similarity with Alan, and then Alan is a director that really likes actors and really likes working with them, and so some directors aren't that interested in the actors and are more interested in like the camera movements and was able to probably because the logistics weren't as heavy in this, was able to do more like talking to me about the character of the guy, about explaining the relationship between Smith and Hume Cronin in this father-son type of almost relationship.